Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It's a podcast that's a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. Arsene Kashkashian, my co-host as always with the Boulder Bookstore. And today we're going to continue our conversation with author Alexandra Fuller about her new novel, Quiet Until the Thaw.
So I wanted to ask you about words. We talked a little bit about this in the radio side of the interview, but words, and Maeve brought this up, words like white supremacy, words like white settlers, colonization, all these. You're a writer, you pay, and this book is very beautifully written. It seems like the words are chosen carefully. And tell us what those words mean and why those words strike sometimes American audiences maybe a little differently than maybe in Africa or...
Well, I think that I've always said, you know, Rhodesia is not a good example of how to be, but it's a terrible warning. And it is racial capitalism in a petri dish. I mean, it happened faster, quicker, and more violently than racial capitalism in this country, by which I mean, you know, by white supremacy. What I mean isn't, you know, I think very often we get an idea that we're talking about the KKK running around in white sheets, and that's certainly a branch of it, or, you know, separatists taking over a wildlife refuge in Oregon, or, you know, these sort of murdering white supremacists. What we don't, I think, have a good understanding of is that white supremacy exists if all the privilege, all the power, all the clean air, all the clean water, all the best land is in the hands of a few white people. And in this country, increasingly, those few white people, I mean, the industrial power, I mean, it's just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. I mean, look around you. For a country as diverse as we are, you go into an airport, you go into an expensive restaurant, you go, you know, anywhere where power and money is, and you generally find it's overwhelmingly white. And that is white supremacy. And white settler is simply the truth of what happened here. You know, white settlers came and spread across this country from east to west. I think one of the reasons why in the West we feel the indigenous community more is that this was the last place to get settled. We're closer to that violence than they are in the East Coast. And so we're closer to that experience of the white settler. That memory should be way more fresh in our minds. It's certainly fresh in the minds of the Lakota, as are, you know, the 500 treaties that the U.S. government made and broke or altered or defaulted on every single one.
Yeah, white settler, it almost seems like a frightening term in the West, you know, because we live with the reservations very close to us, whether it's the Pueblos down south of New Mexico or whether it's the Utes in southern Colorado. I mean, you can't go too far in this region without abutting against Indian land. And so you do sometimes in the back of your mind, that settler stuff is a lot closer here than where I grew up in Philadelphia, where everything is named after Indians, but it's hard to find an Indian.
Well, I love, you know, I love that phrase, the hit pot sings, you know, the hit dog yelps. And when you say white settler to a white settler, they go, oh! And they have a very strong reaction, which should tell them to go inside and examine that disturbance. For me, the great gift I had, truly, I mean, so many great gifts. I mean, first of all, the horror of growing up white supremacist and having to undo that and undo it in the context of a family that didn't change. I mean, it was just me. But that, I think, gave me an edge because it was a lonely, lonely journey forward. And I began to listen to my black friends carefully because those were the voices that had been denied me, you know, for the first 11 years of my life. Then to, you know, write as I did for National Geographic for so long and be sent across the world and see these markers that you can't deny. You know, you go to Haiti, you go to Angola, you go to the res, the same markers exist. Then when you see that disparity, you know, it's organized. That's not an accident. For me, if I'm going to go to the res on assignment, and if every Lakota I meet calls white people white settlers, then I'm going to believe that. If a white person tells me I'm using the wrong terminology, I'm probably going to ignore it. But if The indigenous community are using that term. And, you know, I think that we need to listen to what the black community is saying. This really is, I believe, a time for us to know when to be silent and when to listen. And I really hope that this book offers that, which is an opportunity to listen.
The Pine Ridge Reservation hit headlines around the world with the protests against, or the water protectors, I don't want to use the word protests, we're conscious of language, the water protectors and their stance against the DAPL pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline. And there was a lot of attention paid really only after kind of white media showed up and they set the dogs on some white journalists. And then it was like, oh, that's terrible. But they have been doing this to the native water protectors anyway. But that did hit the headlines and people kind of became aware, at least of the name of where it was. You mentioned a protest against a pipeline at the very end of the book. And yet you started writing this book long before anybody else was paying attention to what was going on in Pine Ridge.
I saw what happened to protesters who frequently, I mean, the Lakota from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation are in constant resistance against the violence of the white settlers on their community. And one of the ways in which, you know, they've tried to do that is to try and get, there's a store, a tiny little town very close to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, which is dry, which is just liquor stores, White Clay, Nebraska. And yet, there's so much profit from selling this awful, you know, malt liquor. I mean, this is not like, to, you know, to a community who's asked not to have it. And then, I mean, this bizarre dance where the police come to protect the white proprietors of the state liquor stores and yet further arrest and, you know, I mean, it's... You can't walk away with your soul intact and see that without knowing, look, I'm contributing to this thing. And in order to not get arrested, some of the protesters against just the alcohol thing, I mean, let alone, yes, they protest every violation of their treaty lands, which spread all the way into Wyoming, and which there are countless of, and they're mostly ignored. You're right in that Standing Rock finally got some attention. But what one of the things that really shocked me, and people can go on and should go on YouTube and see this, the protesters, including women that I had interviewed for this, actually clasped their hands and put irrigation pipes so that they couldn't be separated by the police and put in a police car. So the police got around that. The state troopers got around that by just rounding up the Lakota and cattle trucks. This happened a couple of years ago. I mean, we are not fully aware, I think, of the incredible continuing violence. And, you know, I think to go out there too as a white person and take your discarded clothes or your discarded religion or your whatever, discarded ideas.
Discarded books. Discarded we donate books. The bookstore donates books.
I don't know that books are ever a bad donation because they were a wormhole out of my own violent childhood. So I strongly encourage that. But, you know, I think that what we're missing is that actually what needs to be done is the very, very hard work, our own work, of insisting that our government, including ourselves, honor the treaties just for a start. And that would cause major disruption among white settler communities, but I think a very necessary disruption.
We've talked about some of the characters in the book, Rick Overlooking Horse, but there's another character I'd love to talk about, Mina Overlooking Horse. She's kind of the matriarchal figure, but really a reluctant one. And very often we create these matriarchal, I want to say even caricatures, not just characters, as if they will swoop in and take care of everyone. She does not want to be in charge of these two kids, Rick Overlooking Horse, and then ultimately You Choose Watson. She does it, but I like how you flesh out that character and show that, you know what, they don't always want to do this, these women that we often
right.
read about, Native American women, and in other cultures as well, we have this caricature that we create that these are the women, they're so strong and capable and they will do it all. They don't want to.
Right. And, you know, I think the thing that we forget is sort of, you know, the weaponized fragility of the white woman is the reverse of that. We're all attached to the same coin. And I think we all understand sort of on a cellular level what that weaponized fragility is. It's the freaking out when you get, you know, called upon for taking up more emotional room than you really is your due. And the flip side of that is that we attribute communities that we oppress with the strength because the truth, if we had to say that everybody else is as you know, fragile or is entitled to as much fragility emotionally as they want, it would be such, I think, a humbling call to action, and it should be. So instead, I think we would rather cultivate this easy trope that, you know what, we got our hands off the wheel. We created a system in which Indigenous communities, Black communities are unable to hold their families together. But thank God for the strong women. You know, we're going to incarcerate the Black men and we're going to oppress the Indigenous women. But we don't then have to be there to take care of the children because, wow, the women are magnificent. And I think that that is, you know, again, one of the ways that we mythologize and romanticize in order to get away from our own responsibility. And I come back to that, you know, nosce te ipsum, know yourself, undo your own internal violence.
And of course, we've seen that bootstrap politics, you know, emerge now in policies. All political policy now is around this resilience. If only you were just stronger and pull yourself up by the bootstraps, and no acknowledgement of the system that means that's not possible.
Unless you're white and you get addicted to opium, and then, wow, we're going to put something in the healthcare bill just for you.
Well, that's when it becomes a healthcare crisis as opposed to a criminal issue.
Right.
I wanted to talk about the writing a little bit. The writing is really wonderful in this book. It's short chapters, sketches, really. The language is beautiful. But there's also some magic that happens. You talk about there's going back and forth in time, going back and forth with characters. And as I was reading this, I thought about Kurt Vonnegut and how he would write his books in little pieces, and yet somehow it would create this amazing density and world once you got to the end of the book. And that's really how I felt. Somewhere in the middle of the book, suddenly I started thinking like that. And then when I went back to the beginning, you actually have a one-line quote from Kurt Vonnegut at the beginning of the book, so maybe you seeded that in my mind. But am I just being crazy here, or is it Kurt Vonnegut a bit of an influence?
He's an influence. And, you know, the other thing that was, he is an influence. Of course he is. I think he must have been a meditator. And I don't even, I think for me, by the way, I don't want people in Boulder to go running away with the idea that I'm all Zen at all. But for me, meditation is a way to access my disturbance and to remove my ego from the disturbance and allow the disturbance to speak. That I felt was like, Vonnegut did that like no one else did. But, you know, he's not the only writer. There are so many writers that I feel I'm aiming for something universal. And, you know, for me, my early writers that really woke me up were white writers out of Southern Africa, Brayton Breytenbach, Alan Paton, Doris Lessing. She was an early influence. Nadine Gordimer. Because these were the books we had access to. Black African, Southern African writers didn't have access to editors and publishers in the 70s and 80s. So my wormhole out of the prison of white supremacy was through white people who were criticizing the very system that I was in. But a lot of their language was super spare too. It was like when you're trying to wake people up, you do not tell them a long bedtime story. You give them a short, sharp shock. This is, you know, what Kafka called the axe to the frozen sea inside.
Yeah, I it surprised me as the story went on. You could read this, I guess, in one sitting. I certainly did not. I read it maybe four or five sittings because I needed to put it down, think about it, absorb it, think about what it meant for the characters in the book, think about what it meant politically, what's going on in the world right now. So you really achieve this real density in what could be a short book, but it certainly doesn't feel like that when you read it. I mean that in a good way.
Well, and I think the one thing that I really wanted to demonstrate too, going out on the res, was that, listen, you know, we have this dominant narrative that says the Indian story is history. The Indian story is ongoing. And so the density was super important to show how much is packed in there and how much is to come. This thing is not over by a long, long shot. And so the density was critical. And there's so much that I'm trying to do there in terms of both give what I hope is a vivid portrait of what it is like to be Lakota, but also the key to getting out of that violence, those cycles of violence. Where is that eddy line that we can stop paddling round and round and round and round and round in this boiling pot, find that eddy line, cut out. And we're going to look different if we do that as a nation.
Has anybody on the reservation read the book, or do you have people that might read it, or, you know, what's that relationship as in terms of the book and the reservation and any reaction to it from that point of view?
Well, I inadvertently and by complete mistake, when the book was in its sort of infancy, still on a computer, I was asked to go and do a reading for the National Parks of America. So I did my meditation in the morning, and the instruction was so clear that I take my computer and read from this novel that I was still working on. I hadn't even published it. And a gentleman called Richard Williams, who's the former president of the American Indian College Fund, happened to be at this reading along with other First Nations who National Park Service had sort of rather self-consciously, I think, brought in to advise on how to deal with this mess we've made of their lands. And I stood up and I began to read, and suddenly there was a loud shout from the audience in Lakota. I think that is an important thing. I mean, I think that one needs to read one's work in front of the people to whom, you know, you've done this thing. But yeah, he read it and afterwards found me. And then that soft Lakota way came up and sort of babbled at me. And of course, I'm going, I have no idea what you're saying. And he said, it's all right, little sister, go do your work. And what he was most impressed with and most was that you go speak to white settlers so we don't have to. This is exhausting. It's enough for us just to keep our own culture, our own spirituality, our own stories. You go out and do that hard work. We keep our resources to ourselves. And I thought that was a beautiful instruction to come out with.
Quiet Until the Thaw is the latest book by Alexandra Fuller. It's a novel, and her previous books are memoirs, Don't Let's Go to the Ducks Tonight and Leaving Before the Rains Come. And she's been our guest on After Hours at the Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. Catch the Book Club edition also on our podcast or at news.kgnu.org. Arsene Kashkashian is always my co-host, and I'm Maeve Conran. Alexandra, thank you.
Thank you.